Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Showcasing new authors. This is show number 139, and it is June 12, 2023. And I am your host, Tom Riddell, and co-host Terry Brown will be with us shortly. A brief intro to the show today. We are having author Jeff Ingberg on with special guest Donna Sadawi. And Jeff wrote Rendered Safe, Tales of an NYPD Bomb Tech. So we're really looking forward to that, and let's talk more about us. And you can find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriddell.net. That's thomasriddell.net in the blog section. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge, or find us easily the old-fashioned way on a Google search. Find me on Twitter at TomRiddell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line, and we will certainly get back to you. Special note, we can now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. And I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. And upcoming on authors on The Writer's Lounge here in the next 2 weeks, it will be to be announced. We haven't yet contacted them or got them getting a hold of us. Been a little bit of a problem. I'm having trouble with the email, which is, again, writerslounge2020@yahoo.com, and I'm hoping to get that corrected soon, and we will post when we're ready to review and interview a new author here on the Writer's Lounge on the Facebook page. So go ahead and look for us there if you want to get up-to-date information, but we should be back with you in another 2 weeks. And the next segment of the show is Writer's Topics, and this is where I introduce Terry. And for some reason, and I don't know why, oh, wait a minute. Yes, we do have her here, and didn't think she was here, but I think she's here. And
I am here. Terry,
how are you?
Yes, I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, and here it is in June already, and we're moving right along into the summer months, and it must be nice for you walking along the beach.
It is beautiful here, that's for sure.
And, okay, let's, we're going to do like a brief writer's topics tonight because we have two authors here. I'm hoping that both of them are going to be here. I see one other phone line, so I'm hoping the other one is either with the author or he'll be calling in shortly. I hope that works out. Would love to see both of them here. But anyways, you had mentioned that you want to talk about artificial intelligence and how it relates to authors and writing.
Yeah, it's the big topic right now. Like when I'm on any writer's group right now and they're talking about should you use it or how can you use it, how best to use it. And I'm still very much at a look at it from a distance and wonder what it's going to do to writers. And I wonder if I'm looking at it that way because I'm getting older and I don't like new things and I just think, gosh, what do we need this for? Or if there's really a problem with it. And I can't decide which way I'm leaning right now. So I kind of am standing back and watching carefully and seeing what happens. What are your thoughts on AI?
Oh, a little nerve-wracking, to tell you the truth. I like the idea of it in certain ways, and in some ways it scares the crap out of me. I'm not really sure yet where we're at, and I think the people that are really into creating artificial intelligence are along the same lines as both you and I. They're creating something that might turn into, like, say, Frankenstein's monster. So we don't know what it's going to do, and I hope to God that the people with the torches can hold back the monster and keep it in line somehow so we don't go off the deep end here in this world. But I have a feeling there's going to be problems. I don't know how intense they're going to be, and I don't know how it's going to relate to us as being authors and such. But I think it already is having an effect on our lives. And sometimes we don't even realize it's happening because I'm an Uber driver and I use artificial intelligence to get me around the streets of central New York. And it is working. But again, you know, how much of that is going to be a problem in the future? We really don't know as of yet. But this crazy world that we live in today is so much different than the world that I left behind when I graduated high school in 1975. It is just crazy what's happening with everything, it seems. And I don't know. I don't know. So let's cross our fingers.
I look at it in terms, too. Like when you're talking about, you know, being a writer, and a lot of writers are now trying to use artificial intelligence to write some of their story or to write their blurb or to even just write their social media posts or things along that line. And I think, is that good or is that not good? And part of me says, well, you know, anything that can help you, you know, get the word out is good. And then on the other hand, you know, artificial intelligence it's artificial. That means that everything that's being written by artificial intelligence was written by someone else first. So at what point does it become plagiarism?
Right.
Yeah, I'm just kind of crazy with it. I don't know. I think that there are a lot of things that artificial intelligence has been used for, and it's been good, and it's been helpful. I just don't know where to draw that line.
And we've had plagiarism for centuries.
Exactly.
Yes, I was involved in a case in Minnesota where somebody plagiarized my writing into a book that they wrote and saying it was their words and they weren't, and it wasn't, it was my words. So I have already dealt with that on a lower level, I think, than where we may be going with all this. But it's certainly interesting, and I just think that we just keep holding our ground here, along with artificial intelligence and book banning, which is another topic that we've talked about here on the program. And that also has a lot of gives me a lot of concern for what's going to happen in the future. But I think the good will rule out in the end. And I think that somehow we will come through this. Like we always seem to move through it. And you're a study of history, and I love history too. And we've been through worse. And I think that we can make it through anything here. So anyways, let's get on. Normally we would spend another 5 minutes talking here, but let's get on with the main event. And that would be the guest author intro and interview. And I want to let everybody know at the top of the show, I was a little worried that they're not on here, both of them, and they look to be now. So I will greatly anticipate talking to both them here shortly. But anyways, I want to remind everybody, if you're listening to the show live out there, and I hope that you are, that you can call in and talk to us, maybe briefly, because we have a lot of questions to ask. But the number would be area code 914-219-0868. That's area code 914-219-0868. In my review of Rendered Safe, Donald Sadowie came up through the ranks of NYPD and eventually ended up being a detective on the NYPD bomb squad. As a former Marine, Donald had much of the skills and the mindset to approach the job. His determination and his goal of doing whatever he could to keep the people of New York safer from crime seemed to be baked into who he was as a person. Possibly the right man at the right time could describe him as fate delivered him to investigate the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Not only the people of New York City were grateful, but the citizens of the United States should be thankful that Donald was there with a resolute determination to solve the case and bring justice to whoever was responsible. He did that by risking his life to go down into the highly dangerous and structurally unstable sub-basement. It was there, among all of the mangled cement and debris, that he found a key bit of evidence, a piece of chassis frame that contained a VIN number that led investigators to arrest the ones involved. Fate wasn't done with Donald yet. He entered into the South Tower on 9/11 and nearly died after being buried under the rubble during the collapse of the tower. He still suffers from the events of that day. Donald's career in law enforcement had him in many roles. He was personal bodyguard for UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim. He worked many cases with the bomb squad, including the abortion bomber case, the investigation of TWA Flight 800, and was also involved with global intelligence missions. In addition, he provided protection for Mikhail Gorbachev and Fidel Castro. Rendered Safe brings us in close to the interesting and dangerous world of being a bomb technician and gives us a background or a backstage look of what happens during those fateful world events. It tells of how all of these crimes of humanity changed us and how it changed the life of Donald Sadowie forever. I decided to read Rendered Safe because of my background in public safety and my studies of the criminal justice system. I have the highest regard for the people who serve us as law enforcement officers, and I'm especially grateful for the firefighters, law enforcement, and others who gave their lives and risked their lives on and after 9/11. Donald Sadowie and this story that was told by Jeff Ingber should never be forgotten. The interviews and the knowledge that are contained within this book are gold to those of us who want to better understand what happened 30 years ago. Rendered Safe was very well written, and the author should be applauded for making it available to us. I love this book. And now it is our pleasure to welcome Jeff Ingber and Donald Sadowie to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And let me just open the doors here to those two gentlemen And it looks like they're both here. And I would want to first start off by welcoming Jeff. Welcome both of you. But Jeff, can you tell us about yourself and what prompted and inspired you to write Rendered Safe?
Sure. Thanks, Tom and Terry, for inviting me. Great show so far. So I spent my career, I'm in my late 60s now. I spent my the bulk of my career in the financial industry. I was an attorney for much of the time and then a compliance officer. But my great passion has always been writing. I joke that if I'd been born with a trust fund, I would have just gone straight into writing, but it wasn't before.
Yeah.
So I kind of started getting serious about writing when I had the time, when I stopped working full time. And my first book was a book about the impact of 9/11 on the financial markets. It was 9/11 was devastating to the markets, and it's kind of an unknown, largely unknown story. So that got me familiar with the World Trade Center and terrorism incidents in New York. And skip a book, I wrote a family memoir. But then I collaborated with a fellow named Joe Connor and wrote a book about the 1975 Bronson's Tavern bombing, which was done by the FALN, a Puerto Rican independence group. There were four men killed that day during lunch. One was Joe's father. So I wrote a book with him. And in the course of doing interviews and researching, Joe introduced me to Don. Don had a lot of knowledge about the investigation into Bronson's Tavern bombing and about terrorism and bombing in general. And I came to realize that Don had a fascinating story. So once I finished writing the book with Joe Connor called Shattered Lives, I knew I just had to tell Don's story. And that really led to book number four, which was Rendered Safe.
Very good. And I also understand you're a screenwriter from your bio.
Yeah, I usually when I write a book, I write a screenplay as well. My first screenplay, they tell you to write what you know. And much of my career, I've been in the anti-money laundering field, helping financial institutions to prevent money laundering, which remains a huge issue worldwide. So I wrote a screenplay about a bank examiner examining for money laundering compliance. And that led to, that was the basis actually for a 2019 movie called Crypto with Kurt Russell. That was kind of cool.
Great.
And so I wrote a screenplay on Rendered Safe and other books. Tough business. I'm still trying to shop them around, but I enjoy doing that as well.
Very good. And we have to mention here that Terry and you share something in common. I don't know if Terry is even aware of this, but you both are with Atmosphere Press.
Oh, cool.
Okay. I did not realize that. How fantastic.
See, Terry, I did it again.
It kind of makes sense because it was Cameron Finch of Atmosphere Press that referred me to you, Tom.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Right.
Well,
yeah,
you know,
so
what's interesting is Tom has this thing where I think he's now doing it on purpose, where he tries to find people that I have something in common with, and then I end up becoming like buds, and we write back and forth. And so we're going to rename the show. Instead of the Writer's Lounge, it's going to be Find Terry a Friend.
Right. Oh, showcasing new friends for Terry.
For Terry, something like that,
yes,
yeah.
Right. So... So anyway, Donald, you're there, and I want to say that your heroism and determination to do your job is outlined in this book that Jeff wrote is something that I will long remember. And I want to ask you, how has your life been since those times, since 1993 and 2001?
excuse me. Thank you for having me on the show. Obviously, I'm not a writer, but I had the stories, and I love the way that Jeff writes. But I had the stories, and I think over the years, I became so involved with things that I never really took time to sit back and say, wow, that was really something. There was always something else coming around the corner next. And even after 9/11, I recovered from that, and I have some health problems, but I've gotten over those. I landed up becoming a contractor for the State Department and doing short-term training missions with some former Navy enlisted men overseas that I found very rewarding. I felt that most of my life, I lived the life of a warrior, but I was in the business of saving lives, not taking lives. And I find that very rewarding looking back now.
We can certainly hear your accent there, and you certainly are a New Yorker. I'm from Central New York, but it's glad to have you here, Don. And wow, what a story you have lived through, and I'm just amazed at reading the account of it in Jeff's book. It's been really great. But Terry, you got the next question.
All right. Oh, my gosh, you caught me off guard. You take the next question, and I'll take the one after that, Tom. Sorry.
Okay. Well, so this would be to both of you. Jeff, you can go first. Is there anything you've learned from your experiences and research to show we're better at doing police work in regards to preventing terrorist attacks? And what would you both like to see to improve your safety in this regard, to improve our safety?
That's an interesting question. I think one thing that struck me in writing the book and doing all the research was how naive we were about terrorism back in the early 90s, leading up to the first World Trade Center bombing. You know, Don can attest to it. He lived it. But when the bombing happened, people didn't think it was a bomb. You know, people thought it was a boiler explosion, you know, something internal. People didn't have the mindset. It was before the Oklahoma City bombing. It was obviously before 9/11. So I think one thing that has improved greatly, but that still needs to improve more, is our sensitivity towards the importance of combating terrorism, of identifying it, of taking terrorist threats a lot more seriously than we used to. You know, we have so many more sophisticated tools now, surveillance tools, video and audio and otherwise, which are an enormous help. We have a network of whether you call them spies or informants or intelligence agents that we didn't have then. So we're much better geared up to address and take seriously terrorism than we were then, and I think that's one significant improvement, and we just need to keep going in that regard. I'll
Donald?
Turn it over to Don.
Hello?
Yeah, go
we can
ahead.
Hear you.
Hello? Go ahead.
Donald.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. You can answer that.
I'm reflecting on an answer as I'm listening to the question and the response. I was deeply involved with some of the other law enforcement agencies and intelligence community. I think in looking back, there was a lot of lessons learned where different agencies did not share information in a timely manner. And I eventually was given clearances with three other agencies, and it amazed me how the left hand didn't talk to the right hand, and there's a real loss there in real-time investigations. Some of that has been addressed, but there's mm-hmm. still, I'm going to say on the higher levels, jealousy between agencies, and I found going back to that time and even afterwards, it's the people that I worked with, and I'll call it boots on the ground, from different agencies, we didn't have any problem with sharing information or working together, you know, not leaking anything. and working in small teams and sharing information confidential way and moving forward with these investigations. But we found that the people much higher in the organizations, there was this competition. I'm not directly involved in a lot of that now, but I know some of it has been addressed, but I still have my ear to the ground. I go once a year. I'm invited to a dinner with some people from the intelligence agencies, and I can't say who, but I will say that there are people that come in to New York, and we go out to have dinner somewhere, and I'm like a fly on the wall still. You know, I'm not active in the game anymore, but I'm hearing things that are happening in real time all over the place. The people who operate on the ground are the ones that share the information, but I think when it gets higher up in these organizations, it's there's a lot of politics involved and jealousy.
Would you say it gets kind of diluted would be a word that I might want to use? The importance of the information that comes from boots on the ground gets sort of diluted and it isn't communicated as crisply and intelligently as it should be?
Well, I can only speak from my point of view. You know, stuff that was happening overseas, we weren't getting the information we needed. You know, we acted independently, you know, working in small teams in a task force, and we really relied upon each other and sharing the information. And that's how we got the job done, in spite of the bosses. I mean, even within the NYPD, there were jealousies on a higher level within the detective bureau and the police department. And I'm sad to say, you know, over the years, I've seen it to where it's really ego-based, you know. Some of these bosses stop being cops, you know. They become politicians.
Yes.
And it's sad, you know. But I'm proud to say the people I worked with from the different agencies, regardless of what happened up above, we got the job done. And I'm very happy. I'm still in touch with some of these people, and we still have good, friendly relationships.
Very good. Very good, Don. Now, Terry, you got the next question.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
So, Don, it's mentioned in the book, but what were your thoughts before you went down into the lower levels of the World Trade Center in 1993?
As Jeff had said initially, we thought it was some type of industrial accident. But when we got down there, there was nothing that could have caused that. We got together with the engineers right away from the Trade Center, you know, the building engineers. They've been there for like 30 years. They know every nook and cranny. And they pulled out blueprints and they put them over the hood of a car. And you know, we just kind of huddled together with them. And they said, there's nothing here that could have caused that. Even looking back, the devastation that's there, you really didn't see it on TV. You saw a black smoke coming out of parking garage entrances. If you can imagine a parking garage, giant parking garage, that's like five levels deep, and the hole that was blown in it was approximately the size, width, and length of a football field. There were no floors left. There were no stairwells. It was just pieces of rebar holding on to 12-inch thick pieces of broken cement floor. But the floors were gone. Cars on each level were burnt and crushed beyond recognition. You couldn't tell a Chevy from a Mercedes or a Jaguar or a BMW or a Ford. The cars were virtually crushed down to about 2 feet high, burnt beyond recognition, and it was cold, bitterly cold, and we had the fresh water line was broken, and we had the waste lines that were broken. Later on into the investigation, we developed ear and throat infections. Inadvertently, we were so focused on what we were doing, we were sifting. We set up sifting stations with screens that, you know, you just became so mission orientated. You're touching things, and of course you're wearing a mask, and you rub your nose, you rub your face, and a lot of us got ear and throat infections from it inadvertently. But it was a massive investigation, massive.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to ask if you were wearing any breathing apparatus. So you just had a regular mask on?
Well, actually, I think it was OSHA came down and wanted us, they got us fitted for masks, you know, where you can change the filters each day. And I was a team leader in the task force in my section, and I wore some type of monitoring device that wherever I went, it took in like a small vacuum during the day with battery operated for particles and vapor, analyze that. But to be honest, we had no concern for that or for ourselves. We were just so mission oriented to get into this. And I will tell you, it happened on a Friday at 12:18. We really didn't get a chance to get in there until Saturday, and we still had a fellow missing, Mr. Mikado from Food Services. We were hoping, holding out hope for days, that if we could just crawl down there and take like the back metal part of my knife and bang it on a pipe or piece of cement and call his name, maybe he's still alive. Maybe there's a chance. We never gave up hope for days. We searched and searched, and but he later was found to be killed. He was killed immediately that day. But we never gave up hope searching for him. And I think it was Sunday. I can't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday. I sat on a broken slab, and I just took in the devastation and the people that were killed. And I sat there with my knees pulled up, and I actually felt overwhelmed. I was by myself, and after being down there for some hours searching with Don Haldeman and Steve Vieira and Stevie Dodge, and I sat there almost in tears, and I started to pray. And I asked for God's help to help us find the people who did this.
Right, and then that's when you found the bit of evidence that led the investigators to the prosecuting the individuals responsible, correct?
Yes. It actually, I was asked by the FBI and ATF because I know how to get down there. You again, there was no way to walk down there. You had to climb down, and it was pretty dangerous because you can have things start to do like a landslide, and there's nobody that's going to help you, you know, and it's pretty dangerous to get down there. But I made my way down there with a couple of guys. We spread out looking for the missing person, which we never found until later on. But I was asked to take down a team. Everybody had a different forensic specialty from the different agencies, and do swab samples and photographs and measuring and sketch artists and everything else. And when we were down there, I was working with a fellow from ATF who had just retired from the Army and came on board. His expertise was military ordnance and things of that nature, but mine was a bit different. I was very fortunate that I was a graduate of automotive vocational high school, so I knew car parts very well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that really played a part in this. And I saw pieces of a differential and gears and pinion gears that the average person would have meant nothing to. And I sat down on a broken slab and started putting some of these things together like a puzzle, and I realized to make this thing explode, it had to be the vehicle that carried the bomb. So things started to happen very quickly, and they talked about there was no coordination in the beginning. So there was a call to say everybody got 15 minutes to get out of there because the Port Authority was pulling a train out of a broken tunnel, and there could be collapses where we were. So we had to move very quickly and made a decision to get the people together, get a Stokes basket and a body bag. And I realized very quickly the media's outside. So we got to put these parts in here quickly. We got to cover them with a body bag and take them out and get them to the crime scene laboratory as quickly as we can. I realized about the confidential VIN number from my old partner, Larry Riccio, who was a detective in auto crime. We used to call each other up and talk like two old yentas, you know. Larry, how do you investigate these things? And Donnie, what do you do when you look at a bomb that's blowing up? So we used to share information, and that's how I learned about confidential VIN numbers, and the rest is history.
Very good, very good. Jeff, I know you mentioned a little bit, but Jeff, can you tell us about some of your other writing projects you have worked on, and will there be more to come from you, and do you see yourself writing any fiction in the near future?
I certainly did start out with nonfiction. The 9/11 book I mentioned, I wrote a book about my family. My parents are survivors of the Hungarian Holocaust, so they and their relatives had a pretty interesting story to tell. I mentioned the Francis Tavern book, and of course the book we're talking about now. After my fourth book, my wife said to me, why don't you stop writing about doom and gloom and write something more cheerful? So coincidentally, my son, Craig, married a woman, Emily Paul. Emily Paul's father, Jeff Paul, was a member of the 1964 Staten Island Little League team that won the Little League World Series. It's a really neat story. They're the only New York City team to ever win the Little League Series. It was the first time a U.S. team beat an international team to win the series, in this case, Monterrey, Mexico. They were given a ticker tape parade down Broadway. They're the only kids ever to have a ticker tape parade. And there's a picture of it on the front of the book. So anyway, I thought it would be a great project, and it was. So I interviewed Jeff, and I was able to interview every member of the team who started, and I was able to interview the coach even before he passed away, Bill Rogers, because he was pretty young at the time. So that was kind of fun. And then my last book, I decided to take a crack at fiction, and that's the book that was published by Atmosphere Press. It's to make a long story short, it's about a elderly Holocaust survivor who, you know, struggles with the pain and guilt she feels from the Holocaust years, and getting all that out with the help of a shrink, and then all the secrets that come out. And so it's entitled Daria's Secrets. And I'm working, I've kind of turned to fiction. I decided I like it, so I'm working on, they say write what you know. So I was at Citigroup during the financial crisis, 2007-2008, and Citi, along with AIG, you may recall, was kind of at ground zero. So I met a lot of interesting people and heard and saw a lot of interesting events. So I'm writing a fiction book about that, kind of the rise and fall of a CDO trader, and then also a short story collection. So it's gone from nonfiction to fiction.
Great, great. And Terry, you got the next one?
Yeah, Donald, what would you say to someone who wanted to be a bomb tech today? And what have you really seen in changes since in that profession since 9/11?
Well, I go back to the early 80s, and I will tell you, we had very crude robots, very crude bomb suits, and the emphasis, this is going back to like before World War II, with the military and the NYPD bomb squad, was that you really, really had to hone your skills in what's called hand entry, which is the most dangerous thing. It's the last thing you ever want to do. It's got to be somebody's life is in danger in order to do this, but it's kind of like being a surgeon. And you better know what you're doing before you do it. We had robots that used to break down constantly. We had very old bomb suits. And a lot of it was your skill with an X-ray machine and reading the X-ray and knowing how to go about dealing with things. Were you dealing with a time delay? Were you dealing with a mechanical or electrical booby trap and on and on? It takes about 2 years or more to be trained. Nowadays, fast forward, I've been back to the bomb squad. They have some of the finest equipment that you can have. There's been leaps and bounds, lessons learned in military from the wars in the last 20 years that the EOD teams and the NYPD had input into developing these new robots, much better X-ray equipment, much better bomb suits, more user-friendly, more protection. Everybody watches these movies and thinks that we're, daredevils or something, risk takers. We're actually not. We're probably some of the most boring people you'd want to meet because what we do, we analyze the situation and try to approach it in the safest way. And what was taught to me was that package can kill me. So I don't want to get close to it unless I have to. There's got to be some kind of reason somebody's life's in danger or something like that. And again, that's, you try to use remote procedures, but you have to hone your skills with hand entry because there's been some times in the past where we actually had to get in there quickly and just get the job done. No time for robots, dogs, bomb suits, or X-rays. Just take out your hand entry tools and get to it and get the job done. That's not by choice. But again, anybody going into the field now, you really have to be dedicated. It's an ongoing learning experience. And we landed up making contacts, from my background with the UN, with foreign countries with their bomb tests, which was excellent, because what happens in the Middle East can very easily happen here tomorrow. So it's an ongoing learning experience, sharing information, not from agency to agency, but from bomb tech to bomb tech, and those were invaluable. Those lessons learned, but they're better equipped. Better training, better equipment now than what I had. A lot of times we carried a rosary in our pocket, and my partner would hold it, and I would cut it, and we'd bless ourselves. Wasn't the choice way to go. But sometimes you're forced into those situations.
I would say that you're not boring, and I think a lot of guys that you probably work with are just ordinary guys with a lot of knowledge and skill, which took a lot of, a lot of classroom work maybe and a lot of intelligence to get to do the things that you did. But let's shift here to 9/11. Can you take us through those moments and how have you dealt with the aftermath of that awful day?
That day, I went to work. I was call myself an empty suit. Wore a nice suit. I was a corporate security supervisor. Worked for Merrill Lynch at the world headquarters across the way from the North Tower. I used to go across the street sometime and still have lunch now and then with the building engineers and elevator mechanics that were still my friends from '93. And anyway, I was in the Worldwide Operations Center. My pager went off. My manager texted something that nobody usually texts. He says, come to the crossover where the pedestrian walkway is that comes over from the North Tower and over to where we were, over West Street, forthwith. And I got there, and everybody is like deer in the headlights. And very, very competent people, men and women, are coming in very distressed, crying even, saying a bomb went off. Bomb went off in the basement again. Bomb went off in the lobby. Plane hit the building. These are all credible people, and I realized very quickly from being a detective that you can get 6 or 12 people together that saw the same thing, and they're going to give you a different version. Nobody's lying, but it's just their own interpretation of things. So my manager didn't know what to do, so I said to him, listen, I know that place like the back of my hand. I could walk through that place with the lights off and know where I am. I says, I'm going to go across the way, and when I get back, we'll go upstairs to the executives and let them know if we have to do any partial evacuation or shutdown, because I know time is money in the private sector. Went across the way, as I did, ran into Ron Miller, FBI agent I know. We went into the building, and it was pure chaos. I won't go into the details of the jumpers and other things, but I was more interested in physical damage. Went up to the 20th floor to help evacuate. I remember there was no, you couldn't see the fumes, but the burning fumes you couldn't see, but they were heavier than air, so they were coming down the stairwell. It became very difficult to breathe. And a couple of middle-aged ladies grabbed me by the arm and said, don't try going up any further. Everybody who can get out on their own is getting out. There's nothing else you can do. It's going to be up to the firemen and, you know, the emergency responders. So reluctantly, I was coughing. I came downstairs, and I saw the building engineers, elevator mechanics with the fire chiefs. I saw Father Michael Judge. He looked awful. He was praying with the rosary in his hand, and then there were the jumpers. I won't go into that. Then it was time to leave. And when we were exiting the building, that's when the South Tower, the top part, started coming down. And we ran for our lives. And I knew I wasn't going to make it across the way, across the highway. No way. So I scanned everything, and I saw that there was a short, stubby fire truck the wrong way under the north pedestrian walkway. I ran for that, dove underneath. I had two guys with me. One guy was hit by a piece of debris, and his upper torso was cut in half. There was nothing I could do to help him. Then the other guy who was following us, about the same size and age, we didn't know each other. We just decided to run to that fire truck underneath the pedestrian walkway. And I dove under the truck, making room for the other guy, and he just got swallowed up like a wave at the beach with the debris coming down. And my mind was racing. I got up on the back of that truck, took off my suit jacket, and I guess it's from my Marine Corps training, wrapped it around my arteries of my neck and my temples and my eyes. I remembered my heart's left center of my chest, put that against the back bulkhead, made myself the smallest target I could, and pulled fire hoses over me, and I was in for the ride of my life. Basically, I recall two collapses. I was buried alive. And the worst thing was knowing what's going on and there's no help coming. All I had was the ability to think. And I started to lose that. You remember that those iconic pictures of that toxic cloud over Lower
yes.
Manhattan? I was
yes.
at the bottom of that. And I slowly crawled into a storage bin in the truck. Wasn't great, but it was better than being outside, and I slowly started to suffocate. And people ask me, you know, what do you think about when you think you're going to die? And I thought about all the dangerous things I did by choice and the people I served with, and now I'm a civilian and I'm going to die like
right.
this.
Right.
How ironic. How ironic. I was angry, and honestly, I started to say some prayers to God, and I felt very peaceful, and I said, Lord, whatever's going to happen next, whatever the next world is, I'm about to find out what it is, and I did everything I could, and I'm in your hands now. I still don't know how long I was unconscious, how long I was buried. Eventually, firemen came and were trying to salvage
fire truck, and they pulled debris out, and they opened up a bin, and my fat butt came rolling out unconscious, and they just stepped over me. They were going to leave me. I was just going to be another dead body, and I moved my hand. One of them spotted it, and they stopped what they were doing, and they grabbed me under the arms, and they dragged me for blocks down Vesey Street toward the water, and I was thrown in the arms of five EMTs. And I'll never forget that moment because they were all trying to help me. All they had were their trauma bags. Their ambulances were crushed, destroyed, and they were working on me. And the one guy took the lead, and he was so close, I could feel his breath pulsating, talking to me loudly. You know, listen, we're EMTs, we got you, and you're going to make it. And that was the best thing I could have heard that day. And they worked on me to clear my airways. I couldn't see. I couldn't stand. I couldn't walk. They took me down to the high school where people worked on me. And then I ended up staying in the city at a Merrill Lynch facility for the next day or so. And other people finally helped me get home. But, yeah, that's my story from the day.
Wow. That's incredible. God bless you, Dan, you know, for doing what you did. And you know, your service on NYPD and also on that awful day in 9/11, what you did was heroic, and we're very grateful for you. And Jeff, we're getting close to the end here of the show, but can you tell us how has the publishing, editing, and marketing gone for you with all of your books?
I guess I've come to realize that for most mere mortals like me, you know, you write just for the joy of it. I feel very fortunate to be in an era where you can self-publish, and that's what I did with most of my books. And, you know, you can use social media and other devices, you know, webinars and blogs and the like to publicize your book. But, you know, I spent a lot more publishing and marketing and distributing books than, you know, I will ever make selling them. So, you know, I've done it for the joy of writing.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Did you have, you know, your successes with Atmosphere Press were pretty good, I imagine, right?
I sold a decent number. It was fun working with a professional publishing company, and I'll probably continue to do that, you know, and they help you in other ways, you know, to market, for example, to create an audio book if you want, they, you know, to get on podcasts like this one. So it's good to be a part of a community like that, I will say, as mm-hmm. I guess Terry knows.
Yes.
Yeah. No, Terry. I've said that working with Atmosphere Press is like self-publishing with a lot of professional behind you. You know, you get the best of both worlds, and I really enjoy working with them. So I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Terry, you got the next question, Terry.
Well, pretty much the next question is we're really getting down here to the end, but why don't we ask, so Donald and Jeff both, what do you like to read?
I do a lot of reading because I think it's a truism that, you know, to write well, you have to read a wide range, short stories, fiction, nonfiction. What I read a lot of, I don't write it, but what I find very, very helpful is poetry. I like reading poetry, and it helps me connect the dots a lot when I do my own writing, because mm-hmm. there's sort of a freedom that poets have with words, using certain words, connecting words, taking chances with words and sentences and phrases that I really appreciate and I find helpful.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, what about you?
I like to read a lot about current events and things that are happening in the diplomatic community. I still have friends, you know, within the UN system and the State Department, and I've always had an interest in world affairs ever since working at the UN and seeing how diplomacy is done behind the scenes. That's one thing. The other thing is I like mysteries. I like something of substance that makes you think. I'm a particular big fan of the PBS British shows. But I think for reading, I like reading true stories of man against the odds. I've had the good fortune of meeting some Holocaust survivors, and they autographed a book to me, one in particular, called Promises to Keep. And reading that book, this is a real story of a real person and real events. And it was just amazing, amazing how this person persevered and survived with the help of others. Also, I've met some veterans from World War II, from the American Army, and some of my uncles served in some of the very big battles. But I've also met from the Russian Army and people from the German Army who wrote books. And it was interesting to get a perspective on them, with them trying to survive through some of the unbelievable circumstances during the worst of things. So I like reading about someone who's man against the odds and that they survived. And it's not fiction; it's real stories. But
right.
I do enjoy, on a side note, the British mysteries.
Very good. And Jeff, this is pretty much it for the show. And I would like you to tell everybody where people can find your book or more information on you and of course, Donald.
Easiest place is on Amazon. It's available in paperback, hardcover, and electronic on Kindle. You can also get it at libraries, Barnes & Noble, a wide variety of ways. But the vast majority of the purchases I find are done on Amazon.
Very good. Jeff and Donald, it's been a pleasure. It's right up there is probably one of the best shows that we've ever had here on the Writer's Lounge. It reminds me that, you know, most of us authors write fiction, but there's nonfiction out there too that's quite compelling stuff. And it's about life, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, and you certainly have brought that to us today on this broadcast and within your book too. So I salute both of you, and Donald, again, God bless you for all you've done, and thank you guys so much.
Thank you very much, Tom and Terry, for inviting us, giving us the hour.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. It was an honor to be on.
Okay, Dan.
We enjoyed having
Jeff.
You.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, and again, I got to make sure I hang up on the right people. And Terry, well, as I just mentioned, it's amazing the story that we've just heard with Don talking about what happened. It reminds us of what is most important in our lives, and I can't say it any better than that. How about you?
No, I, when he was talking about, you know, when you read about it is one thing, and when you hear him telling his story verbally, I thought, boy, we should just end right there. We don't even need to say anything else. That was, yeah, I think for those of us who remember 9/11, it is still something that when we hear a story of someone who was there and survived, that it's, I don't know, it's just awe-inspiring.
Yeah, it is. And so we will be back here in 2 weeks, hopefully, with a book to be talked about. And until then, Terry and I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and the eyes to the page. and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and have a good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. Secret of the plot. It's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make